Chapter 10. The Congressman Takes His Belly Dancer to the Jihad. At the age of 6 in Deep East Texas, Carol Shannon had felt the urge to dance. But her family's Baptist congregation viewed dancing as the work of the devil. They preached a doctrine of the man as master of the house with the obligation to whip the evil spirit out of his children. At times, the little girl didn't understand why her father shouted accusations and used his belt on her naked skin, causing it to break and bleed. Then one day, after he had caught her dancing and given her a particularly cruel thrashing, he struck her with his fist again and again. Afterward, alone in her bedroom, she was confused, and then mysteriously she found herself turning on the radio and beginning to dance to the music, swaying before the mirror. As her body began to respond, she began laughing, then laughing louder, and finally laughing with joy. Years later, when her husband, an arch-conservative Texas legislator, decided to run for the state Senate, Charlie Wilson flew in from Washington to organize the opposition. Carol's husband told her that Wilson was a dangerous liberal who would ruin the United States and destroy big business. "He is the enemy," Carol remembers him telling her. But Wilson's candidate won, and Joe Shannon's political career was destroyed. When Carol's marriage began to go sour, she signed up for belly dancing courses to win back her husband's love. One night, she asked him to turn the television off. She lit candles and performed for him. He said it was very interesting and then put out the candles and turned the TV back on. But this Dallas housewife had an unmistakable genius for this unusual dance form. She was a beauty, once Miss C and Ski and Miss Humble Oil. She was now in her late 30s, with black hair and gleaming eyes. Men became infatuated when they saw her perform. Her dreams, however, went beyond such simple triumphs. She'd come to believe that in a previous life she had been Nefertiti, the ancient Egyptian queen of the Nile, and she found that when she danced, this bond with another identity released her spirit, freed her of her childhood terrors. Women started coming to her for lessons. She taught at the junior high school and danced wherever she could, at bachelor parties and retirement events. And then came the breakthrough. In 1978, the Fort Worth Symphony invited her to dance solo in a performance of Samson and Delilah. The devil's work or not, dancing had carried little Carol Shannon of East Texas onto center stage before Fort Worth's high society. A full symphony orchestra, the ultimate symbol of a city's culture, was validating her as a woman and an artist. It was all too much for her husband, who left her a week later. But for the dangerously liberal congressman who had helped destroy Joe Shannon's career, the sight of this exotic housewife appearing like a vision out of the Arabian Nights was irresistible. He befriended her after one of her performances, and soon found himself falling in lust, if not in love. Later, when he was being hounded by the drug investigators, instead of turning to the elevated Joanne Herring, Wilson looked to the small-town girl from Kilgore, Texas. Charlie found Carol Shannon to be a kindred spirit, and when the drug charges mounted and he felt he had no choice but to hold a press conference, she flew to Washington to be with him when he faced the newsmen. That evening, they sat together on the balcony of Wilson's condominium. From there, they could see straight down the Potomac to the Lincoln Memorial, the Capitol, the White House, the Pentagon. Off to the right, they could see the outlines of Arlington National Cemetery. But by far the most dramatic of the patriotic symbols, set just 100 yards away, was the Iwo Jima Memorial, where a Marine honor guard was going through the evening ritual of taking down and folding the American flag. Wilson told her that he had chosen his apartment because of what the statue meant to him, and how badly he now felt for his people back home and for the grief he was causing them. He said he had gone into politics because he wanted to make the country a better place for everyone, and he really wanted to see peace in the world. There were tears in his eyes, she recalls. At the end of the weekend, Carol told the troubled man, "I love you to death. I'm only a plane ride away. If you ever need me, I'll always be there. I'm your friend." Now, 2 months later, it was as if Carol Shannon was stepping into a fairy tale. She was in a first-class seat next to the smiling congressman, heading off to dance for the Egyptian defense minister. "You know that old television show, Queen for a Day? Well, Charlie made me queen for 3 weeks." When they landed in Israel, Tzvi Rafia was waiting at the airport. A U.S. diplomat was also there, by now so familiar with Wilson's routine that he didn't bother the congressman about his schedule. He just handed him a wad of cash, the per diem allotted to all traveling congressmen, and left Wilson to his Israeli friends. Carol was thrilled to be in the land of the Bible. Wilson would disappear with Zvi every morning, sending her off in the embassy's chauffeur-driven Mercedes to see the holy sites. One afternoon, he came back acting like a kid in a candy store, she said. She didn't completely understand what he was talking about, but she remembers that it had to do with T-55 tanks and secret deals with Pakistan. I've never breathed a word about this before, she recalled. And Charlie only gave me bits and pieces, but he was so excited because he thought he was going to be able to do something that no one else could. Charlie is a giver, and here he was saving the world. What Wilson was doing during the day in Israel was scheming with Zvi's associates at IMI, the weapons conglomerate that produces the country's artillery, tank shells, and machine guns. It has the second biggest payroll in Israel, and is inextricably entwined with the military and security apparatus of the Jewish state. Wilson's scheming was conducted not merely out of Carol's sight, but outside that of the U.S. Embassy, which ordinarily monitors congressional activities abroad. One of the reasons for shadowing visiting members of Congress is to discourage them from engaging in negotiations that could place U.S. interests at risk. Wilson, however, never shied away from negotiating, in effect on behalf of his government, and on this occasion he and his Israeli friends had a wide range of business to transact. The Lavi fighter plane was at the top of Israeli aircraft industry's agenda, but Wilson told them not to worry, everything was on track. They turned next to the T-55 upgrade proposal, and to what their congressional friend could offer President Zia on behalf of Israel when he met with him in Pakistan at the end of the week. The Israelis were hoping this deal would serve as the beginning of a range of under-the-table understandings with Pakistan that the congressmen would continue to quietly negotiate for them. Wilson was in his element with these tough Israelis. He had already told Zvi of his frustrations with the CIA. Now, in Tel Aviv, he was challenging IMI to invent a weapon that the Afghans could use to shoot down the murderous Hind helicopters. "You Jews are supposed to be so smart," he said, "so come up with something and I'll get the Pentagon to fund it." Charlie Wilson was marching himself into a true forbidden zone. Congressmen are not allowed to commission a foreign power to design and construct a weapons system, nor do they have the authority to commit the Pentagon to pay for such a weapon. But these were minor outrages compared to Wilson's potentially explosive attempt to bring the Israelis into the Muslim Jihad that the CIA was funding against the Soviets in Afghanistan. It's hard to conceive of anyone other than Charlie Wilson making such a proposition, much less being taken seriously. But such was the stature of this old congressional patron of Israel that the IMI chief immediately set his weapons experts to work. By the time Wilson was ready to leave, they'd presented him with an impressive-looking design, complete with detailed specifications. It was a mule-portable, multi-rocketed device named, to the congressman's delight, the Charlie Horse. Flushed with excitement, Wilson told Zvi and his boss that he would present it to the CIA with an ultimatum, either use it or come up with something better. Somewhere in the deep recesses of his mind, the troubled congressman came up with an ingenious method to enlist the Israelis in the jihad. It helped put the memories of Sabra and Shatila to the back of his mind. The next morning, on March 31, 1983, 5 days into his trip, Wilson and Carol Shannon stepped into the world's most peculiar commercial aircraft. There were no markings on the plane, not even a tail number. This was the Jerusalem to Cairo shuttle, mandated by the Camp David Accords. It was the only flight linking Israel to any part of the Arab world in those days, and Charlie had managed to assemble a marvelously bizarre collection of traveling companions for the flight. Tzvi Rafia, the Israeli whom Wilson had always believed to be a Mossad agent, sat next to his wife, both of them visibly jumpy about this flight into enemy territory. Charlie's Israeli movie star friend, Gila Almagor, no less jumpy, added a certain sparkle to the entourage. The contrast among the passengers was almost comical. The Texas girl filled with innocent excitement at the prospect of seeing Cairo, the three Israelis quaking in their boots. They could barely believe they were on this plane. None of them had dared visit Egypt before, but the congressman wanted his Israeli friends to meet his great Egyptian friend, and he'd assured them safe passage. They would be under the protection of none other than the Egyptian defense minister, Field Marshal Mohammed Abu Razala, and the field marshal himself would be at the airport to greet them. Wilson made it all sound so natural and easy. But by what strange coincidence had this Texas congressman come to be the Egyptian defense minister's intimate friend? The answer begins with Dennis Neal, that resourceful Washington lobbyist who had gone to work for Egypt in 1980 after Camp David restored diplomatic relations between Cairo and Washington. Neal had sensed fantastic foreign aid opportunities for his client, and, knowing Wilson's power and his penchant for personalizing causes, he had urged Abu Razala to cultivate the congressman. It hadn't taken much of an effort. Abu Razala, it turns out, was just Wilson's kind of man, a hero of the 1973 war, a true hater of communists, and, best of all, a Muslim who drank whiskey, loved women, and was possessed with an endless supply of ethnic jokes from every country in the world. Wilson saw him as just plain fun, and as Neal had shrewdly predicted, a friendship blossomed. As the connection grew, miraculously, Charlie Wilson, the old Israeli commando, added another identity to his portfolio, champion of Egypt's foreign aid as well as Israel's.